Chapter 7. Morning brought rain and wind and fog, pessimistic weather that made it hard to believe the previous day had been anything more than a strange and wonderful dream. I wolfed down my breakfast and told my dad I was going out. He looked at me like I was nuts.
In this? To do what?
To hang out with, I started, without thinking. Then, to cover my tracks, I pretended to have a piece of food stuck in my throat, but it was too late. He'd heard me.
Hang out with who? Not those rapper hoodlums, I hope.
The only way to get out of this hole was to dig deeper.
No, you've probably never seen them. They live on the other side of, the island and...
Really? I didn't think anyone lived over there.
Yeah, well, just a few people, like sheep tenders and whatnot. Anyway, they're cool. They watch my back while I'm at the house.
Friends and safety. Two things my dad couldn't possibly object to.
I want to meet them, he said, trying to look stern.
He often put on this face, an imitation of the sensible, no-nonsense dad I think he aspired to be.
Sure thing. We're meeting up over there, though, so another time.
He nodded and took another bite of his breakfast.
Be back by dinner, he said.
Roger, Wilco, Dad.
I practically raced to the bog. As I picked my way through its shifting muck, trying to remember the route of semi-invisible grass islands Emma had used to cross it, I worried that all I would find on the other side was more rain and a ruined house. So it was with great relief that I emerged from the cairn to find September 3rd, 1940, just as I'd left it. The day warm and sunny and fogless, the sky a dependable blue, clouds forming shapes that seemed comfortably familiar. Even better, Emma was there waiting for me, sitting on the edge of the mound casting stones into the bog.
About time, she cried, jumping to her feet. Come on, everyone's waiting for you.
They are?
Yes,
she said with an impatient eye roll, taking my hand and pulling me after her. I sparked with excitement, not only at her touch, but at the thought of the day that lay ahead, full of endless possibility. Though in a million superficial ways it would be identical to the day before, the same breeze would blow and the same tree limbs would fall, my experience of it would be new. So would the peculiar children's. They were the gods of this strange little heaven, and I was their guest. We dashed across the bog and through the forest as if late for an appointment. When we reached the house, Emma led me around to the backyard, where a small wooden stage had been erected. Kids were bustling in and out of the house, carrying props, buttoning up suit jackets, and zipping into sequin dresses. Warming up was a little orchestra, made up of just an accordion, a battered trombone, and a musical saw that Horace played with a bow.
What's this? I asked Emma. Are you guys putting on a play?
You'll see, she said.
Who's in it?
You'll see.
What's it about?
She pinched me. A whistle blew, and everyone ran to claim seats in a row of folding chairs that faced the stage. Emma and I sat down just as the curtain opened, revealing a straw boater hat floating atop a gaudy red and white striped suit. It was only when I heard a voice did I realize that, of course, it was Millard.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he crowed, "it gives me the utmost pleasure to present you a performance like no other in history. A show of such unrivaled daring, of such accomplished magicianship, that you simply won't believe your eyes. Good citizens, I give you Miss Peregrine and her peculiar children."
The audience burst into an uproarious applause. Millard tipped his hat.
"For our first illusion, I will produce Miss Peregrine herself."
He ducked behind the curtain and emerged a moment later, a folded sheet draped over one arm and a peregrine falcon perched on the other. He nodded to the orchestra, which lurched into a kind of wheezing carnival music. Emma elbowed me.
"Watch this," she whispered.
Millard set the falcon down and held the sheet in front, screening the bird from the audience. He began counting backward.
3, 2, 1.
On one, I heard the unmistakable flap of wings, and then saw Miss Peregrine's head, her human head, pop up from behind the sheet to even more uproarious applause. Her hair was mussed, and I could only see her from the shoulders up. She seemed to be naked behind the sheet. Apparently, when you change into a bird, your clothes don't go along for the ride. Taking the edges of the sheet, she wrapped it chastely around herself.
"Mr. Portman," she said, peering down at me from the stage, "I'm so happy you've returned. This is a little exhibition we used to tour around the continent back in the Halcyon days. I thought you might find it instructive."
And then she swept off stage in a flourish, heading into the house to retrieve her clothes. One after another, the peculiar children came out of the audience and took the stage, each with an act of their own. Millard removed his tuxedo so that he was completely invisible and juggled glass bottles. Olive removed her leaden shoes and performed a gravity-defying gymnastics routine on a set of parallel bars. Emma made fire, swallowed it, then blew it out again without burning herself. I applauded until I thought my hands would blister. When Emma returned to her seat, I turned to her and said, "I don't understand. You performed this for people?"
"Of course," she replied. "Normal people?" "Of course, normal people. Why would peculiars pay to see things they can do themselves? But wouldn't this, like, blow your cover?"
She chuckled.
"Nobody suspected a thing," she said. "People come to sideshows to see stunts and tricks and what all, and as far as anybody knew, that's exactly what we showed them."
"So you were hiding in plain sight?"
"Used to be the way most peculiars made a living," she said.
"And no one ever caught on?
Once in a while we'd get some knobhead backstage asking nosy questions, which is why there'd always be a strong arm on hand to toss them out on their bums. Speak of the devil, here she is now."
Up on stage, a mannish-looking girl was dragging a boulder the size of a small refrigerator out from behind the curtain.
"She may not be the sharpest tool in the woodshed," Emma whispered, "but she's got a massive heart, and she'd go to the grave for her mates. We're thick as thieves, Bronwyn and me."
Someone had passed around a stack of promotional cards Miss Peregrine had used to advertise their act. It reached me with Bronwyn's card on top. In her picture, she stood barefoot, challenging the camera with an icy stare. Emblazoned across the back was "The Amazing Strong Girl of Swansea." "Why isn't she lifting a boulder if that's what she does on stage?" I asked.
"She was in a foul mood because the bird made her dress like a lady for the picture. She refused to lift so much as a hat box."
"Looks like she drew the line at wearing shoes, too."
"She generally does."
Bronwyn finished dragging the rock to the middle of the stage, and for an awkward moment, she just stared into the crowd, as if someone had told her to pause for dramatic effect. Then she bent down and gripped the rock between her big hands and slowly lifted it above her head. Everyone clapped and hooted, the kids' enthusiasm undimmed, though they'd probably seen her do this trick 1,000 times. It was almost like being at a pep rally for a school I didn't attend. Bronwyn yawned and walked off with the boulder tucked under one arm. Then the wild-haired girl took the stage. Her name was Fiona, Emma said. She stood facing the crowd behind a planter filled with dirt, her hands raised above it like a conductor. The orchestra began to play "Flight of the Bumblebee," as well as they could, anyway, and Fiona pawed the air above the planter, her face contorted in effort and concentration, As the song crescendoed, a row of daisies poked up from the dirt and unfurled toward her hands. It was like one of those fast-motion videos of plants blooming, except she seemed to be reeling the flowers up from their loamy bed by invisible strings. The kids ate it up, jumping out of their seats to cheer her on. Emma flipped through the stack of postcards to Fiona's.
"Her card's my favorite," she said. "We work for days on her costume."
I looked at it. She was dressed like a beggar girl and stood holding a chicken. "What's she supposed to be?" I asked. "A homeless farmer?" Emma pinched me.
"She's meant to look natural, like a savage-type person. Jill of the Jungle, we called her."
"Is she really from the jungle?"
"She's from Ireland."
"Are there a lot of chickens in the jungle?" She pinched me again. While we'd been whispering, Hugh had joined Fiona on stage. He stood with his mouth open, letting bees fly out to pollinate the flowers that Fiona had grown, like a weird mating ritual. What else does Fiona grow besides bushes and flowers?
"All these vegetables," Emma said, gesturing to the garden beds in the yard. "And trees sometimes."
"Really? Whole trees?"
She sorted through the postcards again. "Sometimes we'll play Jill and the Beanstalk. Someone will grab hold of one of the saplings at the edge of the woods, and we'll see how high Fiona can get it to go while we're riding it."
She arrived at the photo she'd been hunting for and tapped it with her finger.
"That was the record," she said proudly. 20 meters.
"You guys get pretty bored around here, huh?" She moved to pinch me again, but I blocked her hand. I'm no expert on girls, but when one tries to pinch you 4 times, I'm pretty sure that's flirting. There were a few more acts after Fiona and Hugh left the stage, but by then, the kids were getting antsy, and soon we dispersed to spend the rest of the day in summery bliss, lazing in the sun, sipping limeade, playing croquet, tending to gardens that, thanks to Fiona, hardly needed tending, discussing our options for lunch. I wanted to ask Miss Peregrine more about my grandfather, a subject I avoided with Emma, who turned morose at any mention of his name, but the headmistress had gone to conduct a lesson in the study for the younger kids. It seemed like I had plenty of time, though, and the languid pace and midday heat sapped my will to do anything more taxing than wander the grounds in dreamy amazement. After a decadent lunch of goose sandwiches and chocolate pudding, Emma began to agitate for the older kids to go swimming.
"Out of the question," Millard groaned,
the top button of his pants popping open.
"I'm stuffed like a Christmas turkey."
We were sprawled on velvet chairs around the sitting room, full to bursting. Bronwyn lay curled with her head between 2 pillows.
"I'd sink straight to the bottom," came her muffled reply.
But Emma persisted. After 10 minutes of wheedling, she'd roused Hugh, Fiona, and Horace from their naps and challenged Bronwyn, who apparently could not forgo a competition of any kind, to a swimming race. Upon seeing us all trooping out of the house, Millard scolded us for trying to leave him behind. The best spot for swimming was by the harbor, but getting there meant walking straight through town.
"What about those crazy drunks who think I'm a German spy?" I said. "I don't feel like getting chased with clubs today."
"You twit," Emma said. "That was yesterday. They won't remember a thing. Just hang a towel round you so they don't see your, future clothes," said Horace.
I had on jeans and a t-shirt, my usual outfit, and Horace wore his customary black suit. He seemed to be of the Miss Peregrine school of dress, morbidly ultra-formal, no matter the occasion. His photograph was among those I'd found in the smashed trunk, and in an attempt to dress up for it, he'd gone completely overboard. Top hat, cane, monocle, the works.
"You're right," I said, cocking an eyebrow at Horace. "I wouldn't want anyone to think I was dressed weird."
"If it's my waistcoat you're referring to," he replied haughtily. "Yes, I admit I am a follower of fashion."
The others snickered.
Go ahead. Have a laugh at old Horace's expense. Call me a dandy if you will, but just because the villagers won't remember what you wear doesn't give you license to dress like a vagabond.
And with that, he set about straightening his lapels, which only made the kids laugh harder. In a snit, he pointed an accusing finger at my clothes.
As for him, God help us if that's all our wardrobes have to look forward to.
When the laughter had died down, I pulled Emma aside and whispered, "What exactly is it that makes Horace peculiar? Aside from his clothes, I mean."
"He has prophetic dreams. Gets these great nightmares every so often, which have a disturbing tendency to come true."
"How often?"
"A lot."
"Ask him yourself." But Horace was in no mood to entertain my questions, so I filed it away for another time. As we came into town, I wrapped a towel around my waist and hung another from my shoulders. Though it wasn't exactly prophecy, Horace was right about one thing. Nobody recognized me. Walking down the main path, we got a few odd looks, but no one bothered us. We even passed the fat man who'd made such a stink over me in the bar. He was stuffing a pipe outside the tobacconist's shop and blathering on about politics to a woman who was barely listening. I couldn't help staring at him as we passed. He stared back, without even a flicker of recognition. It was like someone had hit reset on the whole town. I kept noticing things I'd seen the day before. The same wagon rushing wildly down the path, its back wheel fishtailing in the gravel, the same women lining up outside the well, a man tarring the bottom of a rowboat, no further along in his task than he'd been 24 hours ago. I almost expected to see my doppelganger sprinting across town pursued by a mob, but I guess things didn't work that way. "You guys must know a lot about what goes on around here," I said, "like yesterday with the planes and that cart."
"It's Millard who knows everything," said Hugh.
"It's true," said Millard.
"In fact, I am in the midst of compiling the world's first complete account of one day in the life of a town, as experienced by everyone in it. Every action, every conversation, every sound made by each of the 159 human and 332 animal residents of Cairnholme, minute by minute, sun up to sun down."
"That's incredible," I said.
"I can't help but agree," he replied. "In just 27 years, I've already observed half the animals and nearly all the humans."
My mouth fell open.
27 years? "He spent 3 years on pigs alone," Hugh said. "That's all day, every day, for 3 years taking notes on pigs. Can you imagine? This one dropped a load of horse biscuits. That one said oink, oink, and then went to sleep in its own filth."
"Notes are absolutely essential to the process," Millard explained patiently.
"But I can understand your jealousy, Hugh. It promises to be a work unprecedented in the history of academic scholarship."
"Oh, don't cock your nose," Emma said. "It'll also be unprecedented in the history of dull things. It'll be the dullest thing ever written."
Rather than responding, Millard began pointing things out just before they happened.
"Miss Higgins is about to have a coughing fit," he'd say, and then a woman in the street would cough and hack until she was red in the face. Or, "Presently, a fisherman will lament the difficulty of plying his trade during wartime." And then a man leaning on a cart filled with nets would turn to another man and say,
"There's so many damned U-boats in the water now, it ain't even safe for a bloke to go tickle his own lines."
I was duly impressed and told him so.
"I'm glad someone appreciates my work," he replied.
We walked along the bustling harbor until the docks ran out and then followed the rocky shore toward the headlands to a sandy cove. We boys stripped down to our underwear, all except Horace, who would remove only his shoes and tie. while the girls disappeared to change into modest, old-school bathing suits. Then we all swam. Bronwyn and Emma raced each other while the rest of us paddled around. Once we'd exhausted ourselves, we climbed onto the sand and napped. When the sun was too hot, we fell back into the water, and when the chilly sea made us shiver, we crawled out again, and so it went until our shadows began to lengthen across the cove. We got to talking. They had a million questions for me, and far away from Miss Peregrine, I could answer them frankly. What was my world like? What did people eat, drink, wear? When would sickness and death be overcome by science? They lived in splendor, but were starving for new faces and new stories. I told them whatever I could, racking my brain for nuggets of 20th century history from Mrs. Johnson's class, the moon landing, the Berlin Wall, Vietnam. But they were hardly comprehensive. It was my time's technology and standard of living that amazed them most. Our houses were air-conditioned. They'd heard of televisions, but had never seen one and were shocked to learn that my family had a talking picture box in almost every room. Air travel was as common and affordable to us as train travel was to them. Our army fought with remote-controlled drones. We carried telephone computers that fit in our pockets, and even though mine didn't work here, nothing electronic seemed to, I pulled it out just to show them its sleek, mirrored enclosure. It was edging toward sunset when we finally started back. Emma stuck to me like glue, the back of her hand brushing mine as we walked. Passing an apple tree on the outskirts of town, she stopped to pick one. But even on tiptoes, the lowest fruit was out of reach, so I did what any gentleman would do and gave her a boost, wrapping my arms around her waist and trying not to groan as I lifted, her white arm outstretched, wet hair glinting in the sun. When I let her down, she gave me a little kiss on the cheek and handed me the apple. "Here," she said, "you earned it." "The apple or the kiss?" She laughed and ran off to catch up with the others. I didn't know what to call it, what was happening between us, but I liked it. It felt silly and fragile and good. I put the apple in my pocket and ran after her. When we came to the bog and I said I had to go home, she pretended to pout. "At least let me escort you," she said. So we waved goodbye to the others and crossed over to the cairn, me doing my best to memorize the placement of her feet as we went. When we got there, I said, "Come with me to the other side a minute." "I shouldn't. I've got to get back or the bird will suspect us."
"Suspect us of what?"
She smiled coyly.
"Of something."
"Something?"
"She's always on the lookout for something," she said, laughing.
I changed tactics.
"Then why don't you come see me tomorrow instead?"
"See you? Over there?"
"Why not? Miss Peregrine won't be around to watch us. You could even meet my dad. We won't tell him who you are, obviously, and then maybe he'll ease up a little about where I'm going and what I'm doing all the time. Me hanging out with a hot girl, that's like his fondest dad dream wish." I thought she might smile at the hot girl thing, but instead, she turned serious.
"The bird only allows us to go over for a few minutes at a time, just to keep the loop open, you know?"
"So tell her that's what you're doing," she sighed.
"I want to. I do, but it's a bad idea."
"She's got you on a pretty short leash."
"You don't know what you're talking about," she said with a scowl. "And thanks for comparing me to a dog. That was brilliant."
I wondered how we'd gone from flirting to fighting so quickly.
"I didn't mean it like that. It's not that I wouldn't like to," she said. "I just can't."
"Okay, I'll make you a deal. Forget coming for the whole day. Just come over for a minute, right now."
"1 minute? What can we do in 1 minute?
I grinned. "You'd be surprised."
"Tell me," she said, pushing me.
"Take your picture?" Her smile disappeared.
"I'm not exactly at my most fetching," she said doubtfully.
No, you're great, really. Just 1 minute. Promise.
I let her go to the cairn first. When we came out again, the world was misty and cold, though thankfully the rain had stopped. I pulled out my phone and was happy to see that my theory was right. On this side of the loop, electronic things worked fine.
"Where's your camera?" she said, shivering. "Let's get this over with."
I held up the phone and took her picture. She just shook her head, as if nothing about my bizarre world could surprise her anymore. Then she dodged away, and I had to chase her around the cairn, both of us laughing, Emma ducking out of view only to pop up again and vamp for the camera. A minute later, I'd taken so many pictures that my phone had nearly run out of memory. Emma ran to the mouth of the cairn and blew me an air kiss.
"See you tomorrow, future boy."
I lifted my hand to wave goodbye, and she ducked into the stone tunnel. I skipped back to town freezing and wet and grinning like an idiot. I was still blocks away from the pub when I heard a strange sound rising above the hum of generators, someone calling my name. Following the voice, I found my father standing in the street in a soggy sweater, breath pluming before him like a muffler exhaust on a cold morning.
"Jacob, I've been looking for you."
"You said be back by dinner, so here I am."
"Forget dinner. Come with me."
My father never skipped dinner. Something was most definitely amiss.
"What's going on?"
"I'll explain on the way," he said, marching me toward the pub. Then he got a good look at me.
"You're all wet," he exclaimed. "For God's sake, did you lose your other jacket too?" And why is your face red? You look sunburned."
Crap. A whole afternoon at the beach without sunblock.
"I'm all hot from running," I said,
though the skin of my arms was pimpled from cold.
"What's happening? Did someone die or what?"
"No, no, no," he said.
"Well, sort of. Some sheep."
"What's that got to do with us?"
"They think it was kids who did it. Like a vandalism thing."
"They who? The sheep police?"
"The farmers," he said. "They've interrogated everyone under the age of 20. Naturally, they're pretty interested in where you've been all day."
My stomach sank. I didn't exactly have a watertight cover story, and I raced to think of one as we approached the priest hole. Outside the pub, a small crowd was gathered around a quorum of very pissed-off-looking sheep farmers. One wore muddy coveralls and leaned threateningly on a pitchfork. Another had Worm by the collar. Worm was dressed in neon track pants and a shirt that read, "I love it when they call me Big Papa." He'd been crying, snot bubbling on his upper lip. A third farmer, rail thin and wearing a knit cap, pointed at me as we approached.
"Here he is," he called out. "Where you been off to, son?"
Dad patted me on the back.
"Tell them,"
he said confidently. I tried to sound like I had nothing to hide.
"I was exploring the other side of the island, the big house."
Knit Cap looked confused.
"Which big house?"
"That wonky old heap in the forest," said Pitchfork. "Only a certified idiot would set foot in there. Place is witched and a death trap to boot."
Knitcap squinted at me.
"In the big house with who?"
"Nobody," I said, and saw Dad give me a funny look.
"Bullocks, I think you was with this one,"
said the man holding Worm.
"I never killed any sheep," cried Worm.
"Shut up,"
the man roared.
"Jake," said my dad,
"what about your friends?"
"Oh, crap, Dad." Knitcap turned and spat.
"Why, you little liar. I ought to belt you right here in front of God and everybody." "You stay away from him," my father said,
doing his best stern dad voice. Knitcap swore and took a step toward him, and he and my dad squared off. Before either could throw a punch, a familiar voice said,
"Hang on, Dennis. We'll get this sorted.
and Martin stepped out of the crowd to wedge himself between them.
"Just start by telling us whatever your boy told you," he said to my father.
Dad glared at me.
"He said he was going to see friends on the other side."
"What friends?"
Pitchfork demanded. I could see this was only going to get uglier unless I did something drastic. Obviously, I couldn't tell him about the children, not that they'd believe me anyway, so instead, I took a calculated risk. "It wasn't anybody," I said, dropping my eyes in feigned shame. "They're imaginary."
"What'd he say?"
"He said his friends were imaginary," my dad repeated, sounding worried. The farmers exchanged baffled glances.
"See?"
Worm said, a flicker of hope on his face.
"Kid's a bloody psycho. It had to be him."
"I never touched them," I said, though no one was really listening.
"It weren't the American,"
said the farmer who had Worm. He gave Worm's shirt a wrench.
"This one here, he's got a history. Few years back, I watched him kick a lamb down a cliffside."
"Wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it with me own eyes. After he done it, I asked him why. To see if it could fly, he says. He's a sickie, all right."
People muttered in disgust. Worm looked uncomfortable but didn't dispute the story.
"Where's his fishmongering mate?" said Pitchfork. "If this one was in on it, you can bet the other one was, too."
Someone said they'd seen Dylan by the harbor, and a posse was dispatched to collect him.
"What about a wolf or a wild dog?" my dad said. "My father was killed by dogs."
"Only dogs on Cairnholme are sheepdogs," replied Nitcap. "And it ain't exactly in a sheepdog's nature to go about killing sheep."
I wished my father would give it up and leave while the leaving was good, but he was on the case like Perry Mason.
"Just how many sheep are we talking about?" he asked.
"Five,"
replied the fourth farmer, a short, sour-faced man who hadn't spoken until then.
"All mine, killed right in their pen. Poor devils never even had a chance to run."
"Five sheep. How much blood do you think is in five sheep?"
"A right tubful, I shouldn't wonder," said Pitchfork.
"So wouldn't whoever did this be covered in it?"
The farmers looked at one another. They looked at me, and then at Worm. Then they shrugged and scratched their heads.
"Reckon it could have been foxes," said Nitcap.
"A whole pack of foxes, maybe," said Pitchfork doubtfully. "If the island's even got that many."
"I still say the cuts are too clean," said the one holding Worm. "Had to have been done with a knife."
"I just don't believe it," my dad replied.
"Then come see for yourself,"
said Nitcap. So as the crowd began to disperse, a small group of us followed the farmers out to the scene of the crime. We trudged over a low rise, through a nearby field, to a little brown shed with a rectangular animal pen beyond it. We approached tentatively and peeked through the fence slats. The violence inside was almost cartoonish, like the work of some mad impressionist who painted only in red. The tramped grass was bathed in blood, as were the pen's weathered posts and the stiff white bodies of the sheep themselves, flung about in attitudes of sheepish agony. One had tried to climb the fence and got its spindly legs caught between the slats. It hung before me at an odd angle, clamshelled open from throat to crotch, as if it had been unzipped. I had to turn away. Others muttered and shook their heads, and someone let out a low whistle. Worm gagged and began to cry, which was seen as a tacit admission of guilt, the criminal who couldn't face his own crime. He was led away to be locked in Martin's museum, in what used to be the sacristy and was now the island's makeshift jail cell, until he could be remanded to police on the mainland. We let the farmer to ponder his slain sheep and went back to town, plodding across wet hills in the slate-gray dusk. Back in the room, I knew I was in for a stern dad talking to, so I did my best to disarm him before he could start in on me. I lied to you, Dad, and I'm sorry.
Yeah?
He said sarcastically, trading his wet sweater for a dry one.
That's big of you. Now, which lie are we talking about? I can hardly keep track.
The one about meeting friends. There aren't any other kids on the island. I made it up because I didn't want you to worry about me being alone over there.
Well, I do worry, even if your doctor tells me not to.
I know you do.
So what about these imaginary friends? Does Golan know about this?
I shook my head. That was a lie, too. I just had to get those guys off my back. Dad folded his arms, not sure what to believe.
Really?
Better to have them think I'm a little eccentric than a sheep killer, right? I took a seat at the table. Dad looked down at me for a long moment, and I wasn't sure if he trusted me or not. Then he went to the sink and splashed water on his face. When he toweled off and turned around again, he seemed to have decided it was a lot less trouble to trust me.
You sure we don't need to call Dr. Golan again?
He asked.
Have a nice, long talk?
If you want to, but I'm okay.
This is exactly why I didn't want you hanging out with those rapper guys, he said,
because he needed to close with something sufficiently parental for it to count as a proper talking to. You were right about them, Dad, I said, though secretly I couldn't believe either of them was capable of it. Worm and Dylan talk tough, but that was all. Dad sat down across from me. He looked tired.
I'd still like to know how someone manages to get a sunburn on a day like this.
Right, the sunburn.
Guess I'm pretty sensitive, I said. You can say that again, he said dryly.
He let me go, and I went to take a shower and thought about Emma. Then I brushed my teeth and thought about Emma and washed my face and thought about Emma. After that, I went to my room and took the apple she'd given me out of my pocket and set it on the nightstand. And then, as if to reassure myself she still existed, I got out my phone and looked through the pictures of her I'd taken that afternoon. I was still looking when I heard my father go to bed in the next room, and still looking when the Jennies kicked off and my lamp went out, and when there was no light anywhere but her face on my little screen, I lay there in the dark, still looking. Chapter 8. Hoping to duck another lecture, I got up early and set out before Dad was awake. I slipped a note under his door and went to grab Emma's apple, but it wasn't on my nightstand where I'd left it. A thorough search of the floor uncovered a lot of dust bunnies and one leathery thing the size of a golf ball. I was starting to wonder if someone had swiped it when I realized that the leathery thing was the apple. At some point during the night, it had gone profoundly bad, spoiling like I've never seen fruit spoil. It looked as though it had spent a year locked in a food dehydrator. When I tried to pick it up, it crumbled in my hand like a clump of soil. Puzzled, I shrugged it off and went out. It was pissing rain, but I soon left gray skies behind for the reliable sun of the loop. This time, however, there were no pretty girls waiting for me on the other side of the cairn, or anyone for that matter. I tried not to be too disappointed, but I was a little. As soon as I got to the house, I started looking for Emma, but Miss Peregrine intercepted me before I'd even made it past the front hall.
"A word, Mr. Portman,"
she said, and led me into the privacy of the kitchen, still fragrant from the rich breakfast I'd missed. I felt like I'd been summoned to the principal's office. Miss Peregrine propped herself against the giant cooking range.
"Are you enjoying your time with us?" she said.
I told her I was, very much.
"That's good," she replied, and then her smile vanished. "I understand you had a pleasant afternoon with some of my wards yesterday, and a lively discussion as well."
"It was great. They're all really nice." I was trying to keep things light, but I could tell she was winding me up for something.
"Tell me," she said, "how would you describe the nature of your discussion?"
I tried to remember. "I don't know. We talked about lots of things. How things are here, how they are where I'm from."
"Where you're from?"
"Right. And do you think it's wise to discuss events in the future with children from the past?" "Children? Is that really how you think of them?" I regretted saying this, even as the words were passing my lips.
"It is how they regard themselves as well," she said testily. "What would you call them?"
Given her mood, it wasn't a subtlety I was prepared to argue. "Children, I guess."
"Indeed. Now, as I was saying," she said, emphasizing her words with little cleaver chops of her hand on the range, "do you think it's wise to discuss the future with children from the past?"
I decided to go out on a limb.
"No?" "Ah, but apparently you do. I know this because last night at dinner we were treated by Hugh to a fascinating disquisition on the wonders of 21st century telecommunications technology."
Her voice dripped with sarcasm.
"Did you know that when you send a letter in the 21st century, it can be received almost instantaneously?"
"I think you're talking about email."
"Well, Hugh knew all about it."
"I don't understand," I said. "Is that a problem?" She unleaned herself from the range and took a limping step toward me. Even though she was a full foot shorter than I was, she still managed to be intimidating.
"As an Embryn, it is my sworn duty to keep those children safe, and above all that means keeping them here, in the loop, on this island."
"Okay."
"Yours is a world they can never be part of, Mr. Portman. So what's the use in filling their heads with grand talk about the exotic wonders of the future? Now you've got half the children begging for a jet airplane trip to America, and the other half dreaming of the day when they can own a telephone computer like yours."
"I'm sorry, I didn't realize."
"This is their home. I have tried to make it as fine a place as I could. But the plain fact is, they cannot leave, and I'd appreciate it if you didn't make them want to."
"But why can't they?" She narrowed her eyes at me for a moment and then shook her head.
"Forgive me. I continue to underestimate the breadth of your ignorance."
Miss Peregrine, who seemed to be constitutionally incapable of idleness, took a saucepan from the stovetop and began scouring it with a steel brush. I wondered if she was ignoring my question or simply weighing how best to dumb down the answer. When the pan was clean, she clapped it back on the stove and said,
"They cannot linger in your world, Mr. Portman, because in a short time they would grow old and die."
"What do you mean, die?"
"I'm not certain how I can be more direct. They'll die, Jacob."
She spoke tersely, as if wishing to put the topic behind us as quickly as possible.
"It may appear to you that we've found a way to cheat death, but it's an illusion. If the children loiter too long on your side of the loop, all the many years from which they have abstained will descend upon them at once, in a matter of hours."
I pictured a person shriveling up and crumbling to dust like the apple on my nightstand.
"That's awful," I said with a shudder. "The few instances of it that I've had the misfortune to witness are among the worst memories of my life. And let me assure you, I've lived long enough to see some truly dreadful things."
"Then it's happened before."
"To a young girl under my own care. Regrettably, a number of years ago. Her name was Charlotte. It was the first and last time I ever took a trip to visit one of my sister Embryns. In that brief time,
Charlotte managed to evade the older children who were minding her and wander out of the loop. It was 1985 or 86 at that time, I believe. Charlotte was roving blithely about the village by herself when she was discovered by a constable. When she couldn't explain who she was or where she'd come from, not to his liking anyhow, the poor girl was shipped off to a child welfare agency on the mainland. It was 2 days before I could reach her, and by that time she'd aged 35 years. I think I've seen her picture, I said. A grown woman in little girl's clothes? Miss Peregrine nodded somberly. She never was the same after that. Not right in the head.
What happened to her?
She lives with Miss Nightjar now. Miss Nightjar and Miss Thrush take all the hard cases.
But it's not as if they're confined to the island, is it? I asked. Couldn't they still leave now? From 1940?
Yes, and begin aging again as normal. But to what end? To be caught up in a ferocious war? To encounter people who fear and misunderstand them? And there are other dangers as well. It's best to stay here.
What other dangers? Her face clouded, as if she regretted having brought it up.
Nothing you need concern yourself with. Not yet, at least. With that, she shooed me outside. I asked again what she meant by other dangers, but she shut the screen door in my face.
Enjoy the morning, she chirped, forcing a smile. Go find Miss Bloom. I'm sure she's dying to see you.
And she disappeared into the house. I wandered into the yard, wondering how I was supposed to get the image of that withered apple out of my head. Before long, though, I did. It's not that I forgot, it just stopped bothering me. It was the strangest thing. Resuming my mission to find Emma, I learned from Hugh that she was on a supply run to the village, so I settled under a shade tree to wait. Within 5 minutes, I was half asleep in the grass, smiling like a dope, wondering serenely what might be on the menu for lunch. It was as if just being here had some kind of narcotic effect on me, like the loop itself was a drug, a mood enhancer and a sedative combined, and if I stayed too long, I'd never want to leave. If that were true, I thought, it would explain a lot of things, like how people could live the same day over and over for decades without losing their minds. Yes, it was beautiful, and life was good, but if every day were exactly alike, and if the kids really couldn't leave, as Miss Peregrine had said, then this place wasn't just a heaven, but a kind of prison, too. It was just so hypnotizingly pleasant that it might take a person years to notice, and by then, it would be too late. Leaving would be too dangerous. So it's not even a decision, really. You stay. It's only later, years later, that you begin to wonder what might have happened if you hadn't. I must have dozed off, because around mid-morning, I woke to something nudging my foot. I cracked an eye to discover a little humanoid figure trying to hide inside my shoe, but it had gotten tangled in the laces. It was stiff-limbed and awkward, half a hubcap tall, dressed in army fatigues. I watched it struggle to free itself for a moment and then go rigid, a wind-up toy on its last wind. I untied my shoe to extricate it and then turned it over, looking for the wind-up key, but I couldn't find one. Up close, it was a strange, crude-looking thing, its head a stump of rounded clay, its face a smeared thumbprint.
"Bring 'em here," someone called from across the yard.
A boy sat waving at me from a tree stump at the edge of the woods. Lacking any pressing engagements, I picked up the clay soldier and walked over. Arranged around the boy was a whole menagerie of wind-up men, staggering around like damaged robots. As I drew near, The one in my hands jerked to life again, squirming as if he were trying to get away. I put it with the others and wiped shed clay on my pants.
"I'm Enoch," the boy said. "You must be him."
"I guess I am," I replied.
"Sorry if he bothered you," he said, herding the one I'd returned back to the others. "They get ideas, see? Ain't properly trained yet. Only made 'em last week."
He spoke with a slight Cockney accent. Cadaverous black circles ringed his eyes like a raccoon, and his overalls, the same ones he'd worn in pictures I'd seen, were streaked with clay and dirt. Except for his pudgy face, he might have been a chimney sweep out of Oliver Twist.
"You made these?" I asked, impressed.
"How?"
"They're homunculi," he replied. "Sometimes I put doll heads on them, but this time I was in a hurry and didn't bother."
"What's a homunculi?"
"More than one homunculus."
He said it like it was something any idiot would know.
"Some people think it's homunculuses, but I think that sounds daft, don't you?"
"Definitely." The clay soldier I'd returned began wandering again. With his foot, Enoch nudged it back toward the group. They seemed to be going haywire, colliding with one another like excited atoms.
"Fight, you Nancies!"
he commanded, which is when I realized they weren't simply bumping into one another, but hitting and kicking. The errant clay man wasn't interested in fighting, however, and when he began to totter away once more, Enoch snatched him up and snapped off his legs.
"That's what happens to deserters in my army," he cried, and tossed the crippled figure into the grass, where it writhed grotesquely as the others fell upon it.
"Do you treat all your toys that way?"
"Why?" he said. "Do you feel sorry for them?"
"I don't know. Should I?"
"No. They wouldn't be alive at all if it wasn't for me."
I laughed, and Enoch scowled at me.
"What's so funny?"
"You made a joke."
"You're a bit thick, aren't you?" he said. "Look here."
He grabbed one of the soldiers and stripped off its clothes. Then with both hands, he cracked it down the middle and removed from its sticky chest a tiny, convulsing heart. The soldier instantly went limp. Enoch held the heart between his thumb and forefinger for me to see.
"It's from a mouse," he explained. "That's what I can do. Take the life of one thing and give it to another. Either clay like this, or something that used to be alive, but ain't anymore."
He tucked the stilled heart into his overalls.
"Soon as I figure out how to train 'em up proper, I'll have a whole army like this. Only, they'll be massive."
And he raised an arm up over his head to show me just how massive.
"What can you do?" he said.
"Me? Nothing, really. I mean, nothing special like you."
"Pity," he replied. "Are you going to come live with us anyway?"
He didn't say it like he wanted me to, exactly. He just seemed curious.
"I don't know,"
I said.
"I hadn't thought about it."
That was a lie, of course. I had thought about it, but mostly in a daydreaming sort of way. He looked at me suspiciously.
"But don't you want to?"
"I don't know yet." Narrowing his eyes, he nodded slowly, as if he just figured me out. Then he leaned in and said under his breath,
"Emma told you about Ray the Village, didn't she?"
"Ray the what?" He looked away.
"Oh, it's nothing. Just a game some of us play."
I got the distinct feeling I was being set up.
"She didn't tell me," I said.
Enoch scooted toward me on the stump.
"Oh, I bet she didn't," he said. "I bet there's a lot of things about this place she wouldn't like you to know."
"Oh, yeah? Why?"
"'Cause then you'll see it's not as great as everybody wants you to think, and you won't stay."
"What kinds of things?" I asked.
"Can't tell," he said, flashing me a devilish smile. "I could get in big trouble."
"Whatever," I said.
"You brought it up."
I stood to go.
"What?"
he cried, grabbing my sleeve.
"Why should I if you're not going to tell me anything?"
He rubbed his chin judiciously,
It's true. I ain't allowed to say anything. But I reckon I couldn't stop you if you was to go upstairs and have a look in the room at the end of the hall.
Why? I said. What's in there?
My friend Victor. He wants to meet you. Go up and have a chat.
Fine, I said. I will. I started toward the house and then heard Enoch whistle. He mimed running a hand along the top of a door.
The key, he mouthed.
What do I need a key for if someone's in there?
He turned away, pretending not to hear. I sauntered into the house and up the stairs like I had business there and didn't care who knew it. Reaching the second floor unobserved, I crept to the room at the end of the hall and tried the door. It was locked. I knocked, but there was no answer. Glancing over my shoulder to make sure no one was watching, I ran my hand along the top of the doorframe. Sure enough, I found a key. I unlocked the door and slipped inside. It was like any other bedroom in the house. There was a dresser, a wardrobe, a vase of flowers on a nightstand. Late morning sun shone through drawn curtains the color of mustard, throwing such yellow light everywhere that the whole room seemed encased in amber. Only then did I notice a young man lying in the bed, his eyes closed and mouth slightly open, half hidden behind a lace curtain. I froze, afraid I'd wake him. I recognized him from Miss Peregrine's album, though I hadn't seen him at meals or around the house, and we'd never been introduced. In the picture, he'd been asleep in bed just as he was now. Had he been quarantined? Infected with some sleeping sickness? Was Enoch trying to get me sick, too?
Hello, I whispered. Are you awake?
He didn't move. I put a hand on his arm and shook him gently. His head lolled to one side. Then something terrible occurred to me. To test a theory, I held my hand in front of his mouth. I couldn't feel his breath. My finger brushed his lips, which were cold as ice.
Shocked, I pulled my hand away. Then I heard footsteps and spun around to see Bronwyn in the doorway.
You ain't supposed to be in here, she hissed.
He's dead, I said.
Bronwyn's eyes went to the boy and her face puckered.
That's Victor.
Suddenly it came to me where I'd seen his face. He was the boy lifting the boulder in my grandfather's pictures. Victor was Bronwyn's brother. There was no telling how long he might have been dead. As long as the loop kept looping, it could be 50 years and only look like a day.
What happened to him? I asked.
Maybe I'll wake old Victor up, came a voice from behind us, and you can ask him yourself.
It was Enoch. He came in and shut the door. Bronwyn beamed at him through welling tears.
Would you wake him? Oh, please, Enoch.
I shouldn't, he said. I'm running low on hearts as it is, and it takes a right lot of 'em to rise up a human being, even for just a minute.
Bronwyn crossed to the dead boy and began to smooth his hair with her fingers.
Please,
she begged.
It's been ages since we talked to Victor.
Well, I do have some cow hearts pickling in the basement, he said, pretending to consider it. But I hate to use inferior ingredients. Fresh is always better.
Bronwyn began to cry in earnest. One of her tears fell onto the boy's jacket, and she hurried to wipe it away with her sleeve.
Don't get so choked, Enoch said. You know I can't stand it. Anyway, it's cruel, waking Victor. He likes it where he is.
And where's that? I said.
Who knows? But whenever we rouse him for a chat, he seems in a dreadful hurry to get back.
What's cruel is you toying with Bronwyn like that and tricking me, I said. And if Victor's dead, why don't you just bury him? Bronwyn flashed me a look of utter derision.
Then we'd never get to see him, she said.
That stings, mate, said Enoch. I only mentioned coming up here because I wanted you to have all the facts, like, I'm on your side.
Yeah? What are the facts, then? How did Victor die? Bronwyn looked up.
He got killed by an ow!
She squealed as Enoch pinched the back of her arm.
Hush, he cried. It ain't for you to tell.
This is ridiculous, I said. If neither of you will tell me, I'll just go ask Miss Peregrine. Enoch took a quick stride toward me, eyes wide.
Oh, no, you mustn't do that.
Yeah? Why mustn't I?
The bird don't like us talking about Victor, he said. It's why she wears black all the time, you know. Anyway, she can't find out we've been in here. She'll hang us by our pinky toes.
As if on cue, we heard the unmistakable sound of Miss Peregrine limping up the stairs. Bronwyn turned white and dashed past me out the door, but before Enoch could escape, I blocked his path.
Out of the way, he hissed.
Tell me what happened to Victor.
I can't.
Then tell me about Raid the Village.
I can't tell you that neither.
He tried to shove past me again, but when he realized he couldn't, he gave up.
All right, just shut the door and I'll whisper it to you.
I closed it just as Miss Peregrine was reaching the landing. We stood with our ears pressed to the door for a moment, listening for a sign that we'd been spotted. The headmistress's footsteps came halfway down the hall toward us, then stopped. Another door creaked open, then shut.
She's going into her room, Enoch whispered.
So? I said.
Raid the village.
Looking like he was sorry he'd brought it up, he motioned me away from the door. I followed, leaning down so he could whisper into my ear.
Like I said, it's a game we play. It works just like the name says.
You mean you actually raid the village?
Smash it up, chase people round, take what we like, burn things down. It's all a good laugh.
But that's terrible.
We got to practice our skills somehow, don't we? Case we ever need to defend ourselves. Otherwise, we'd get rusty. Plus, there's rules. We ain't allowed to kill anybody. Just scare them up a bit, like. And if someone does get hurt, well, they're back white as rain the next day and don't remember nothing about it.
Does Emma play too?
Nah, she's like you. Says it's evil.
Well, it is. He rolled his eyes.
You two deserve each other.
What's that supposed to mean? He rose up to his full 5'4" height and poked a finger into my chest.
It means you better not get all high and mighty with me, mate. Because if we didn't raid the damn village once in a while, most of this lot would have gone off their heads ages ago.
He went to the door and put his hand on the knob, and then turned back to face me.
And if you think we're wicked, wait till you see them.
Them who? What the hell is everyone talking about? He held up one finger to shush me, then went out. I was alone again. My eyes were drawn to the body on the bed. What happened to you, Victor? Maybe he'd gone crazy and killed himself, I thought. Gotten so sick of this cheerful but futureless eternity that he'd guzzled rat poison or taken a dive off a cliff. Or maybe it was them, those other dangers Miss Peregrine had alluded to. I stepped into the hall and had just started toward the stairs when I heard Miss Peregrine's voice behind a half-closed door. I dove into the nearest room and stayed hidden until she'd limped past me and down the stairs. Then I noticed a pair of boots at the front of a crisply made bed. Emma's boots. I was in her bedroom. Along one wall was a chest of drawers and a mirror. On the other, a writing desk with a chair tucked underneath. It was the room of a neat girl with nothing to hide, or so it seemed, until I found a hat box just inside the closet. It was tied up with string, and in grease pencil, across the front was written, Private. Correspondence of Emma Bloom. Do not open. It was like waving red underwear at a bull. I sat down with the box in my lap and untied the string. It was packed with 100 or more letters, all from my grandfather. My heart picked up speed. This was exactly the kind of gold mine I'd hoped to find in the old ruined house. Sure, I felt bad about snooping, but if people here insisted on keeping things secret, well, I'd just have to find stuff out for myself. I wanted to read them all, but was afraid someone would walk in on me, so I thumbed through them quickly to get an overview. Many were dated from the early 1940s during Grandpa Portman's time in the Army. A random sampling revealed them to be long and sappy, full of declarations of his love and awkward descriptions of Emma's beauty and my grandfather's then broken English. "You are pretty like flower. Have good smell also. May I pick?" In one, he'd enclosed a picture of himself posing atop a bomb with a cigarette dangling from his lips. Over time, his letters grew shorter and less frequent. By the 1950s, there was maybe one a year. The last was dated April 1963. Inside the envelope was no letter, just a few pictures. Two were of Emma, snapshots she'd sent him that he'd sent back. The first was from early on, a jokey pose to answer his, of her peeling potatoes and pretending to smoke one of Miss Peregrine's pipes. "Peeling spuds and dreaming of you," she'd written along its bottom. "Come home soon. Love, your potato." The next photo was sadder, a lonely silhouette of Emma gazing out a window, as if waiting for Abe to appear on the lawn. One of her hands rested on a birdcage, and on the back of the photo she'd written, "Feeling caged without you. Won't you write? I worry so." She'd sealed her note with a kiss, so to speak, a big pink smack of lipstick. The last photo was the last thing my grandfather had ever sent her. It showed him at middle age, holding a little girl. She curled into him, as if afraid to let go, lest she might never see him again. Underneath, he had written simply, "This is why." I had to stare at the last picture for a minute before I realized who the little girl was. It was my Aunt Susie, maybe 4 years old then. After that, there were no more letters. I wondered how much longer Emma had continued writing to my grandfather without receiving a reply, and what he'd done with her letters. Thrown them out? Stashed them somewhere? Surely it had to be one of those letters that my father and aunt had found as kids that made them think their father was a liar and a cheat. How wrong they were. I heard a throat clear behind me and turned to see Emma glaring from the doorway. I scrambled to gather the letters, my face flushing, but it was too late. I was caught. "I'm sorry. I shouldn't be in here."
"I'm bloody well aware of that," she said, "but by all means, don't let me interrupt your reading."
She stamped over to her chest of drawers, yanked one out, and threw it clattering to the floor.
"While you're at it, why don't you have a look through my knickers, too?"
"I'm really, really sorry," I repeated. "I never do things like this."
"Oh, I shouldn't wonder. Too busy peeping in ladies' windows, I suppose."
She towered over me, shaking with anger, while I struggled to fit all the letters back into the box.
"There's a system, you know. Just give them here. You're mucking everything up."
She sat down and pushed me aside, emptying the box onto the floor and sorting the letters into piles with the speed of a postal worker. Thinking it best to shut my mouth, I watched meekly while she worked. When she'd calmed a little, she said,
"So you want to know about Abe and me, is that it? Because you could have just asked."
I didn't want to pry.
"Rather a moot point now, wouldn't you say?"
"I guess."
"So, what is it you want to know?"
I thought about it. I wasn't really sure where to start. "Just what happened?"
"All right, then. We'll skip all the nice bits and go right to the end. It's simple, really. He left. He said he loved me and promised to come back one day, but he never did."
"But he had to go, didn't he? To fight?"
"Had to. I don't know.
He said he wouldn't be able to live with himself if he set out the war while his people were being hunted and killed. Said it was his duty. I suppose duty meant more to him than I did. Anyhow, I waited. I waited and worried through that whole bloody war, thinking every letter that came was a death notice. Then, when the war was finally over, he said he couldn't possibly come back. Said he'd go stark raving. Said he'd learned how to defend himself in the army, and he damn well didn't need a nanny like the bird to look after him anymore. He was going to America to make a home for us, and that he'd send for me. So I waited more. I waited so long that if I'd actually gone to be with him, I would have been 40 years old. By then, he'd taken up with some commoner, and that, as they say, was that. I'm sorry. I had no idea. It's an old story. I don't drag it out much anymore.
You blame him for being stuck here, I said. She gave me a sharp look.
Who says I'm stuck?
Then she sighed.
No, I don't blame him. Just miss him is all.
Still?
Every day.
She finished sorting the letters.
There you have it, she said, clapping the lid on them. The entire history of my love life in a dusty box in the closet.
She drew a deep breath, and then shut her eyes and pinched the bridge of her nose. For a moment, I could almost see the old woman hiding behind her smooth features. My grandfather had trampled her poor, pining heart, and the wound was still raw, even these many years later. I thought of putting my arm around her, but something stopped me. Here was this beautiful, funny, fascinating girl who, miracle of miracles, really seemed to like me. But now I understood that it wasn't me she liked. She was heartbroken for someone else, and I was merely a stand-in for my grandfather. That's enough to give anyone pause, I don't care how horny you are. I know guys who are grossed out by the idea of dating a friend's ex. By that standard, dating your grandfather's ex would practically be incest. The next thing I knew, Emma's hand was on my arm. Then, her head was on my shoulder, and I could feel her chin tracking slowly toward my face. This was kiss-me body language, if there ever was such a thing. In a minute, our faces would be level, and I'd have to choose between locking lips or seriously offending her by pulling away. And I'd already offended her once. It's not that I didn't want to, more than anything I did, but the idea of kissing her 2 feet from a box of obsessively well-preserved love letters from my grandfather made me feel weird and nervous. Then her cheek was against mine, and I knew it was now or never, so I said the first mood-killing thing that popped into my head. Is there something going on between you and Enoch? She pulled away instantly, looking at me like I'd suggested we dine on puppies.
What? No. Where on earth did you get a twisted idea like that?
From him? He sounds kind of bitter when he talks about you, and I get the distinct impression he doesn't want me around, like I'm horning in on his game or something. Her eyes kept getting wider.
First of all, he doesn't have any game to horn in on, I can assure you of that. He's a jealous fool and a liar.
Is he?
Is he which?
A liar. She narrowed her eyes.
Why? What kind of nonsense has he been spouting?
Emma, what happened to Victor? She looked shocked. Then, shaking her head, she muttered,
Damn that selfish boy.
There's something no one here is telling me, and I want to know what it is.
I can't, she said. That's all I've been hearing. I can't talk about the future. You can't talk about the past. Miss Peregrine has us all tied up in knots.
My grandfather's last wish was for me to come here and find out the truth. Doesn't that mean anything? She took my hand and brought it into her lap and looked down at it. She seemed to be searching for the right words.
You're right, she said finally. There is something. Tell me. Not here, she whispered. Tonight.
We arranged to meet late that night, when my dad and Miss Peregrine would be asleep. Emma insisted it was the only way, because the walls had ears, and it was impossible to slip off together during the day without arousing suspicion. To complete the illusion that we had nothing to hide, we spent the rest of the afternoon hanging out in the yard in full view of everyone, and when the sun began to set, I walked back to the bog alone.